John Durham, while he waited for Madame de Malrive to draw on her gloves, stood in the hotel doorway looking out across the Rue de Rivoli at the afternoon brightness of the Tuileries Gardens. His European visits were infrequent enough to have kept unimpaired the freshness of his eye, and he was always struck anew by the vast and consummately ordered spectacle of Paris. Paris might still be the most beautiful city in the world, but whether it were the most lovable or the most detestable depended for John Durham in the last analysis on the buttoning of the white glove over which Fanny de Malrive seemed unnaturally intent to linger.
Madame de Trême, adapted from the novella of Edith Wharton by John Peacock, with Anna Massey as Madame de Trême, Philip Voss as John Durham, and Gwen Humble as Fanny de Malrive.
There. It's done. Shall we leave?
Of course.
I shall walk home. The carriage has gone ahead. Will you walk with me, John? Let us cross the Tuileries. I should like to sit a moment on the terrace.
Well?
I don't know when I've been so happy as I was just now, taking tea with your mother and sisters.
Of course, it was an immense pleasure for them to see you again.
Oh, not in the same way. I mean that it was not an event for them as it was for me.
An event?
To be with real good Americans again.
If it's merely our Americanism you enjoyed, we can give you all you want in that line.
Merely that. I felt safe with them. As safe as in a bank. How familiar it all sounded. The old New York names that kept coming up in your mother's talk, and her ideas about Europe, regarding it as a great big innocent pleasure ground.
And a shop for Americans.
Yes, and missing the homemade bread, and preferring the American asparagus. I'm so tired of Americans who despise even their own asparagus. And then your married sister spending her summers at, what is it, the Kittiwatawny house on Le Pohunk?
Oh, but my married sister is the black sheep of the family. The rest of us never sank as low as that.
Low? It's beautiful. I remember going to such a place once. They have early dinner, rather late, and go off in buckboards over terrible roads and bring back golden rod and autumn leaves. And there's always one shy man in flannels, only one, who has come to see the prettiest girl and who takes her off in a buggy for hours and hours. It's 15 years since I was in America.
And you're still so good an American.
Oh, a better and better one every day.
Then why did you never come back?
It was impossible. My husband would not go. And since our separation, well, there have been family reasons.
Why talk of reasons? The truth is, you've made your life here. You could never give all this up.
Give it up? I would go tomorrow. But now, it could never be for more than a visit.
I see.
I must live in France on account of my boy.
It's an agreement?
I gave my word. They knew that that was enough. It would have been much more difficult for me to obtain complete control of my son if I was to leave France.
But when he's grown up, then you would feel freer.
Yeah, he is only 8 years old.
Of course. When I spoke to you the other day about myself, about what I felt for you, I said nothing about the future because for the moment my mind refused to travel beyond its immediate hope of happiness. But I felt, of course, that we couldn't come together as we might once have done, thinking only of ourselves. Whatever your answer is to be, I want to tell you now that I'm ready to accept my share of the difficulties. If there's the least chance of your marrying me, I'm willing to live over here as long as you can keep your son with you.
You are very generous, John. Very unselfish. But when you fix a limit, no matter how remote, to my remaining here, I see how wrong it is to let myself consider the possibilities that we have been talking of.
Wrong? Why should it be wrong?
Because I must endeavor to keep my boy always. Not in the sense of living with him, but because the moment he passes out of my influence, he passes under that influence I have been fighting against every hour since he was born. There is nothing in your experience, in any American experience, to correspond with that far-reaching French family organization. Everything is prepared in advance. His political and his religious convictions, his judgments of people, his sense of honor, his ideas of women, his whole view of life. He is taught to see vileness and corruption in everyone not of his own way of thinking. And this forming of the mind begins with the child's first consciousness. It's in his nursery stories, his baby prayers, his very games with his playmates. Already he is only half mine, because the church has the other half, and they will be reaching out for my share as soon as his education begins. But that other half is still mine, and I mean to make it the strongest and most living half of the two. So when the inevitable conflict begins, the energy and the truth and the endurance shall be on my side and not on theirs.
There might be a great deal to urge on the other side. The ineffectualness of your sacrifice. The probability that when your son marries, he will inevitably be absorbed back into the life of his class and his people. But I can't look at it in that way. Because if I were in your place, I believe I should feel just as you do about it. And one reason why I understand your feeling about your boy is that I had the same feeling about you. As long as there's a fighting chance of keeping my half of you, the half that he is willing to spare me, I don't see how I can ever give it up. If you marry me, I'll agree to live out here as long as you want. And we'll be two instead of one to keep hold of your half of him.
Ah, I am glad to have had this said to me. But I could never accept such an offer.
That doesn't mean that you could never accept me.
Under such conditions.
But if I am satisfied with the conditions, I've worked long enough and successfully enough to take my ease and take it where I choose. The life I offer you is offered to your boy as well. The offer I make is made deliberately. And at least I have a right to a direct answer.
My direct answer, then, is, if I were still Fanny Frisbee, I would marry you.
But you will be when the divorce is announced.
Ah, the divorce.
Do you so dislike the idea?
The idea of divorce? No, not in my case. I should like anything that would do away with the past, obliterate it all, make everything new in my life.
Then what?
Oh, don't ask me. I don't know. I am frightened.
Well, tell me exactly what you're afraid of.
The divorce. They will never consent to it.
But you're absolutely certain of your divorce.
If they ever let it come into the courts.
How can they prevent that?
My never knowing how they will do things is one of the secrets of their power.
Their power? What power? Who are they? You told me yourself that your husband is the least likely to give you trouble, and the others are his uncle, the abbé, his mother and sister. Well, that kind of a syndicate doesn't scare me much. A priest and two women against the world?
Not against the world, but with it. Their whole world is behind them. It's that mysterious solidarity that you can't understand. One doesn't know how far they may reach or in how many directions. I have never known. They have always cropped up where I least expected them.
Do you think it's the people of that kind that I'll ever consent to give you up?
They're not wantonly wicked. They'll leave me alone as long as...
As long as I do. Do you want me to leave you alone? Was that what you brought me here to tell me?
I don't know why I brought you here. Except from the wish to prolong a little the illusion of being once more an American among Americans. Just now, sitting there with your mother and Katie and Nanny, the difficulties seemed to vanish. The problems grew as trivial to me as they are to you. I wanted them to remain so a little longer. I wanted to put off going back to them. But it was of no use. They were waiting for me here. They are over there now, in that house across the river. They are a part of me. I belong to them. I must go back to them.
Then I go back with you. I don't mean into your house, but into your life.
I never saw anything so French.
John knew her in his college days when she lived in West 33rd Street. She was not so French then. But she did have...
What, Mother?
All the Frisbees had what novelists call dash.
I've seen where she lives.
Bon Marché.
Well, that's not very dashing. If that's all she got by marrying a marquis, it must be simply freezing in winter.
Well, I like her.
You would have liked her more in West 33rd Street, Katie. Oh, I wish we'd never gone to Ouchy last year. I wish we'd never seen the Hotel Beau Rivage.
I hope he marries her.
Oh.
Fanny suffered Durham to accompany her to the door of the house where she lived, and allowed their debate to prolong itself through the almost monastic quiet of the quarter which led thither.
But if it were possible to ascertain in advance that your husband's family would not oppose it, would you apply for a divorce?
I may do, but I will never move in the matter. There must be no scandal, nothing which my boy could afterward regard as the faintest blur on his much-courted escutcheon. Besides, who would I approach in my family to discuss the matter? There is no one to whom I can entrust so delicate an investigation.
But surely you've told me that your husband's sister, what is her name? Christiane de Trim, was the most powerful member of the group, and that she's always been on your side.
Yes, Christiane has been on my side. She dislikes her brother, but it would not do for me to ask her.
But could no one else ask her? Who are her friends?
She has a great many, and some, of course, are mine. But in a case like this, they would be all hers. They wouldn't hesitate a moment between us, and I could never know if what I was told was the truth. Don't you see?
I'm not sure that I do. But if you can't find out what Madame de Trem thinks, I'll see what I can do myself.
Oh, you... Why didn't this happen to Fanny Frisbee?
Why had it not happened to Fanny Frisbee? Durham put this question to himself as he walked back along the quays in a state of inner commotion, which left him for once insensible to the ordered beauty of his surroundings. The arduous task of making the acquaintance of Madame de Trem had begun. He bethought himself of applying to his cousin, Mrs. Boykin.
You say Fanny's been very nice to your mother and the girls. Well, I dare say she's beginning to feel the need of friends she can really trust. She has dropped all her American friends since her marriage. The excuse was that de Malrive didn't like them. But as she's been separated for 5 or 6 years, I can't see... And as for her French relations... That Malrive said is the worst in the Faubourg. Of course, you know what he is. Even the family, for decency's sake, had to back her up and urge her to get a separation. And Christiane de Trem...
Is she so very reprehensible, too?
Oh, I can't speak from personal experience. I know Madame de Trem slightly. I've met her at Fanny's. But she never remembers the fact, except when she wants me to go to one of her Vente de Charité. They all remember us then. And some American women are silly enough to ruin themselves at the smart bazaars and fancy they'll get invitations in return. They say Mrs. Addison G. Pack followed Madame Dalglad around for a whole winter and spent 100,000 francs at her stalls. And at the end of the season, Madame Dalglad asked her to tea. And when she got there, she found that was a charity, too, and she had to pay 100 francs to get in. Elmer, dear, that is not my way.
Ah, Durham, how are you? Didn't see you at Auteuil this afternoon. You don't race?
No, sir. Infrequently.
Oh, busy sightseeing, I suppose.
Personally, I have no desire to thrust myself into French society. I can't see how any American woman can do so without a loss of self-respect. But anyone can tell you about Madame de Trem.
I wish you would, then.
Well, I think Elmer had better...
What's that, Bessie? Oh, Madame de Trem. She has not been like a happy country. Had a history. Several of them. Someone said she constituted the gossip page of the Faubourg Daily News. Not that I speak from personal knowledge. Bessie and I have never cared to force our way. Of course, you know the Prince Darmiac by sight.
No.
No? Oh, I'm surprised at that. Well, he's one of the choicest ornaments of the jockey club. Very fascinating to the ladies, I believe, but the deuce and all at baccarat. Ruined his mother and a couple of maiden aunts already. And now, Madame de Tram has put the family pearls up the spout and is wearing imitation for love of him.
I had that straight from my maid's cousin, who's employed by Madame de Tram's jeweler.
Oh, it's straight enough. More than she is.
Be careful of what you say, Elmer. I suspect John of being seriously smitten by the lady.
Ever do anything with the foils, John? Darmiac is what they call here a fiend lamb.
Oh, I don't mean to resort to bloodshed unless it's absolutely necessary. But I do mean to make the lady's acquaintance.
I'm afraid you must apply for an introduction to more fashionable people than we are. Elmer and I so thoroughly disapprove of French society that we've always declined to take any part in it. But why should not Fanny de Malrive arrange a meeting for you?
I don't think she's on very intimate terms with her husband's family.
You mean that she's not allowed to introduce her friends to them?
Oh, my dear fellow, the way they treat the Americans over here, it's really... excuse me. That's another chapter, you know.
How some people can stand
it. There's a letter for you, Bessie.
Oh, thank you. Look at that, my dear John. Another card to one of their everlasting bazaars. Oh, why, it's at Madame Darmiac's, the prince's mother. 50 francs admission, rien que cela, to see some of the most disreputable people in Europe. And if you're an American, you're expected to leave at least 1,000 behind you. Their own people naturally get off cheaper. There's your opportunity to see Madame de Trem. She'll be there.
Make it 2,000, and she'll ask you to tea.
There is nothing very redoubtable about Madame de Trem, except perhaps the kindly yet critical observation which she bestowed on Americans. The unblinking attention of a civilized spectator observing an encampment of Aborigines. She was a beauty. If beauty, instead of being restricted to the cast of the face, is a pervasive attribute informing the hands, the voice, the gestures, the very fall of a flounce and tilt of a feather. In this impalpable aura of grace, Madame de Tram's dark, meager presence unmistakably moved, like a thin flame in a wide quiver of light.
You wish to marry my sister-in-law?
Yes, I do. So far, however, the wishing is entirely on my side.
I understand, but have been given reason to hope.
Every man in my position gives himself his own reasons for hoping.
You spent a great deal of money the other day at our bazaar.
Yes. I wanted to have a talk with you. And it was the readiest, if not the most distinguished, means of attracting your attention.
I understand.
It is because I suspect you of understanding everything that I have been so anxious for this opportunity.
And as John realized that she looked much handsomer than she was, so while they talked, he felt that she understood a great deal more than she betrayed.
Shall we sit a moment? You permit me, then, to say that I believe I understand a little of our good Fanny's mind.
On that point, I have no authority to speak. I am here only to listen.
Listen, then. You have persuaded her that there would be no harm in divorcing my brother, since I believe your religion does not forbid divorce.
Madame de Malrive's religion sanctions divorce in such a case as...
as my brother has furnished. Yes, I have heard that your race is stricter in judging such écarts. But you must not think that I defend my brother. Fanny must have told you that we have always given her our sympathy.
She has. Let me infer it from her way of speaking of you.
How cautious you are. I am so straightforward that I shall have no chance with you.
You will be quite safe. Unless you're so straightforward that you put me on my guard.
At this rate, we shall never get any farther. And in 2 minutes, I must go back to my mother's visitors. Why should we go on fencing? The situation is really quite simple. Tell me just what you wish to know. I have always been Fanny's friend, and that disposes me to be yours.
Well, then, what I wish to know is what position your family would take if Madame de Malrive should sue your brother for a divorce. I naturally wish to be clear on this point before urging my cause with your sister-in-law.
My poor Fanny might have asked me that herself.
I beg you to believe that I'm not acting as her spokesman. I merely wish to clear up the situation before speaking to her in my own behalf.
You are the most delicate of suitors. But I understand your feeling. Fanny also is extremely delicate. It was a great surprise to us at first. Still, in this case, since she has no religious scruples and she had no difficulty in arranging a separation, why should she fear any in demanding a divorce?
I don't know that she does. But the mere fact of possible opposition might be enough to alarm the delicacy you observed in her.
Ah, yes. On her boy's account.
Partly, doubtless, on her boy's account.
So that if my brother objects to a divorce, all he has to do is to announce his objection. But, my dear sir, you are giving your case into my hands.
Since you say you are Madame de Malrive's friend, could there be a better place for it?
I am Fanny's friend, certainly. But with us, family considerations are paramount, and our religion forbids divorce.
So that, inevitably, your brother will oppose it.
I really should go in. My mother will never forgive me for deserting
but
her.
But surely you owe me an answer.
In return for your purchases at my stall?
No. In return for the trust I have placed in you.
Certainly I wish to see you again. You interest me. But it is so difficult to arrange. If I were to ask you to come here again, my mother and uncle would be surprised, and at Fanny's...
Oh, no, not there.
Well, where then? Is there any other house where we are likely to meet?
Not unless you'll come and dine with me.
Dine with you? Au cabaret? That would be diverting, but impossible.
Well, dine with my cousin, then. I have a cousin, an American lady, who lives here.
An American lady whom I know.
Well, by name, at any rate. You send her cards for all your charity bazaars.
We do exploit your compatriots.
Oh, I don't think she's ever gone to the bazaars.
But she might if I dined with her.
Still less, I imagine.
I like that. And I accept. But what is the lady's name?
Yes, Bessie. Madame de Trem wishes to dine with you.
I'm not surprised. I wonder you are, Elmer. Didn't you tell me that Armiac went out of his way to speak to you the other day at the races? And at Madame Dalglad's sale? Oh, yes, I went there after all, just for a few minutes, because I found Katie and Nanny were so anxious to be taken. Well, that day I noticed that Madame de Trem was quite empressé when we went up to her stall. Oh, I didn't buy anything. I merely waited while the girls chose some lampshades. They thought it would be interesting to take home something painted by a real marquise. And, of course, I didn't tell them that those women never make the things they sell at their stalls. But I repeat, I'm not surprised. I suspected that Madame de Trem had heard of our little dinners. You know, they're really horribly bored in that pokey old faubourg. My poor John. I see now why she's been making up to you. But on one point, I am quite determined, Elmer. Whatever you say, I shall not invite the Prince d'Armiac.
During dinner, Christiane de Trem used her narrow gaze like a knife slitting open the unsuspicious personalities about her. Nanny and Katie were the special objects of her observation. Madame de Trem ignored in their favor the other selected guests, the fashionable art critic, the old legitimist general, the beauty from the English embassy, the whole impressive marshalling of Bessie Boykin's social resources. When the men returned to the drawing room, Madame de Trem, at Durham's approach, let him see that it was for him she had been reserving herself. She had the art of making it seem quite natural that they should move away together to the remotest of Mrs. Boykin's fire-drawn salons, and there, in a glaring privacy of brocade and ormolu, she should turn to him with a smile which avowed her intentional quest of seclusion.
confess that I have done a great deal for you.
In coming to dine with my cousin?
Let us say in giving you this half hour.
For that I'm duly grateful. And shall be still more so when I know what it contains for me.
I'm not sure. You will not like what I am going to say.
Shall I not?
You appear to have no idea of the difficulties.
Should I have asked your help if I'd not had an idea of them?
But you are still confident that with my help you can surmount them.
I can't believe you've come here to take that confidence from me.
And all this I am to do for your beaux yeux.
No, for your own. Hmm? That you may see with them what happiness you are conferring.
You are extremely clever, and I like you. But my family will not hear of a divorce.
When you speak of your family, do you include yourself?
I thought you understood that I am simply their mouthpiece.
I have only to thank you, then, for not keeping me longer in suspense.
Sit down a moment longer. I am very sorry for you and Fanny, but you are not the only persons to be pitied.
The only persons?
In our unhappy family. I, for instance, whose help you ask. If you could guess how I need help myself.
I am so sorry. Is there any way in which I can be of use to you?
Oh, if you would, if you would. There is nothing I would not do for you. I have still a great deal of influence with my mother, and what my mother commands, we all do. I could help you. I am sure I could help you. But not if my own situation were known. And if nothing can be done, it must be known in a few days.
Well, tell me what I can do.
How dare I? Your race is so cautious, so self-controlled. You have so little indulgence for the extravagances of the heart. And my folly has been incredible and unrewarded. I have lent money. My husband's, my brother's, money that was not mine. And now I have nothing to repay it with. Alas, what must you think of me? How can I explain my humiliating myself before a stranger? Only by telling you the whole truth. The fact that I am not alone in this disaster. That I could not confess my situation to my family without ruining myself and involving in my ruin someone who, however undeservedly, has been as dear to me as you are to...
Oh, no.
Even that does not move you. You have asked a great deal of me. Much more than you can guess. Do you mean to give me nothing? Not even your sympathy in return? Is it because you have heard horrors of me? When are they not said of a woman who is married unhappily? Well, perhaps not in your fortunate country, where she might seek liberation without dishonor. But here, oh, you have seen the consequences of our disastrous marriages. You may yet be the victim of our cruel and abominable system. Have you no pity for one who has suffered in the same way, and without the possibility of release? It is not because you are not rich. At such times, the crudest way is the shortest. And I don't pretend to deny that I know I am asking you a trifle. You Americans, when you want a thing, you always pay 10 times what it is worth. And I am giving you the wonderful chance to get what you most want at a bargain. Madame de Trem said she must have money to pay her debts. But Durham knew that was only a pretext which she scarcely expected him to believe. She wanted the money for someone else. That was what her allusion to a fellow victim meant. She wanted it to pay the prince's gambling debts. It was at that price that Durham was expected to buy the right to marry Fanny Frisbee. You refuse?
Only because of the return you propose to make me.
Ah, you are all incredible. You are quite at liberty to repeat our conversation to your friend.
Durham did not take advantage of the permission thus strangely flung at him. Of his talk with her sister-in-law, he gave only to Fanny de Malrive that which concerned her.
So you see how I have failed in my mission. There is no hope.
I have never known them to declare themselves so plainly.
Neither Durham nor Fanny needed to voice the reminder of his promise to regard the subject of their marriage as closed when once the other side had defined its position.
I have decided to leave Paris tomorrow.
Oh, give me a day or two longer.
If I can be of the least use, I'll give you 100 days.
Just let me feel that you are there, just for a day or two, till I have readjusted myself to the idea of going on in the old way.
But to hang around the shut door of his hopes was more than even Durham's passion required of him. He decided to go away for a few weeks immediately. His mother and sisters wished to be taken to the Italian lakes, but he would return to Paris and say his real farewell to Fanny before he sailed for America in July.
Fanny is here to see you, John.
Please tell her...
Let me see you before you go, John. Something extraordinary has happened.
Would you mind leaving us alone, Mother?
But I... No, of course not. Fanny.
Thank you. Madame de Trenne came to visit me yesterday, officially delegated by her family to announce that my husband has decided not to oppose my suit for divorce. Oh, it's the long habit, you know, of not believing them, of looking for the truth always in what they don't say. Oh, it took me hours and hours to convince myself that there's no trick under it, that there can't be any.
Then you are convinced now.
I am convinced because the facts are there to reassure me. Christiane tells me that my husband has consulted his lawyers and that they have advised him to free me. Maître Angara has been instructed to see my lawyer whenever I wish. They quite understand that I should never have taken the step in face of any opposition on their part. I am so thankful to you for making that perfectly clear to them. And I suppose this is the return their pride makes to mine, for they can be proud collectively. I owe it all to you. Christiane said that it was your talk with her that convinced them.
Did Madame de Trem give you any reason for this change of front?
Oh, yes, just what I said. It was really her admiration of you, of your attitude, your delicacy. She said that at first she hadn't believed in it. Oh, they're always looking for a hidden motive. And when she found that yours was staring at her in the actual words you said, that you really respected my scruples and would never, never try to coerce or entrap me, something in her... Oh, poor Christiane, answered to it. She told me that she wanted to prove to us that she was capable of understanding us, too. If you knew her history, you'd find it wonderful and pathetic that she can.
Whatever our sympathies may be with Christiane, I feel I must not meet her again. I shall leave Paris as planned while the preliminary divorce negotiations are taking place.
The lawyers have said the process will not be a long one.
Monsieur de Malrive's acquiescence reduced the divorce to a formality. And when, at the end of June, Durham returned from Italy with Katie and Nanny, there seemed no reason why he should not stay in Paris long enough to learn what progress had been made.
Poor Christiane is here. She is very unhappy. You have seen in the papers...
I have seen no papers since we left Turin. What has happened?
The Prince d'Armagnac has come to grief. There has been some terrible scandal about money, and he has been obliged to leave France to escape arrest.
And Madame de Trem has left her husband?
Oh, no, poor creature. They don't leave their husbands. They can't. But de Trem has gone down to their place in Brittany, and as my mother-in-law is with another daughter in Auvergne, Christiane came here for a few days. With me, you see, she need not pretend. She can cry her eyes out.
And that is what she's doing?
Poor thing. If you saw her, you would feel nothing but pity. She is suffering so horribly that I reproach myself for being happy under the same roof.
I should like to see her.
It is natural, knowing what she has done for us, that you should want to show her your sympathy. The difficulty is that that is just the one thing you can't show her. You can thank her, of course, for ourselves, but even that at the moment...
would seem brutal. Yes, I recognize that I should have to choose my words.
I can tell her. And when you come back tomorrow...
Oh, I'm so sorry, I...
Dear Christiane, may I leave Mr. Durham in your charge for 2 minutes? I have promised Nanny that I shall see the boy put to bed.
Of course. I don't think that in this house your time will hang so heavy that you need my help in supporting it.
It was not for that reason that Madame de Malrive asked you to remain with me.
Why then? Surely not in the interest of preserving appearances, since she is safely upstairs with your sister.
No, but simply because I asked her to. I told her I wanted to speak with you.
How you arrange things. And what reason can you have for wanting to speak to me?
Can't you imagine? The desire to thank you for what you've done.
Oh, as for what I have done.
Don't speak as if you regretted it.
Regret working for the happiness of two such excellent persons? Can't you fancy what a charming change it is for me to do something so innocent, so beneficent?
Don't talk in that way. However much one of the persons of whom you speak may have deserved it.
One of the persons? Do you mean me?
I mean myself, as you know. You have been generous, extraordinarily generous.
Ah, but I was doing good in a good cause. You have made me see that there is a distinction.
I'm here to let you say whatever you choose to me.
Whatever I choose. Has it never occurred to you that I may conceivably choose to say nothing?
Quite conceivably. So much so that I'm aware I must make the most of this opportunity, because I'm not likely to get another.
But what remains of your opportunity if it isn't one to me?
It still remains for me an occasion to abase myself. There is only one thinkable pretext for detaining you. It is that I may still show my sense of what you've done for me.
How do you propose to show that sense?
By offering in return, in any form and to the utmost, any service you are forgiving enough to ask of me.
You are princely. But, my dear sir, does it not occur to you that I may meanwhile have taken my own way of repaying myself for any service I have been fortunate enough to render you?
I don't know how you can have repaid yourself for anything so disinterested. But I'm sure at least that you've given me no chance of recognizing ever so slightly what you have done.
Don't be too sure. You have given me a chance, and I have taken it. Taken it to the full. So fully that if I were to accept any farther service you may choose to offer, I should simply be robbing you. Robbing you shamelessly. I was entitled, wasn't I, to take something in return for the service I had the happiness of doing you.
So much so that I can't see how you can have left me nothing to add to what you say you have taken.
Ah, but you don't know what it is. And what's more, you wouldn't believe me if I told you.
How do you know?
You didn't believe me once before. And this is so much more incredible.
I shall go away unhappy unless you tell me. But then, perhaps I have deserved to.
I can't send you away unhappy, since it is in the contemplation of your happiness that I have found my reward.
The next day, Durham left with his family for England, with the intention of not returning till after the divorce should have been pronounced in September. To say that he left with a quiet heart would be to overstate the case. The fact that he could not communicate to Madame de Malrive the substance of his talk with her sister-in-law still hung upon him uneasily. But of definite apprehensions the lapse of time gradually freed him, and Madame de Malrive's letters reflected in their reassuring serenity the undisturbed course of events. Early in the month of September, however, it became necessary for Durham to go to France to confer with a business associate. Although it had been agreed between himself and Madame de Malrive they would communicate only by a daily interchange of notes, Madame de Malrive's tender ingenuity found a means of tempering his privation.
My dear John, Christiane is passing through Paris on her way from Treville, and has promised to see you for me if you will call on her today. She thinks there is no reason why you should not go to the Hotel Marive, as you will find her there alone. The family have all gone to Auvergne. She is really our friend and understands.
That afternoon, Durham presented himself at the proud old house beyond the Seine.
It is extraordinary, my receiving you here. But que voulez-vous? There was no other place. And I would do more than this for our dear Fanny.
It seems to me that you're also doing a great deal for me.
Perhaps you will see that I have my reasons.
You have put me still more deeply in your debt. I wish you would make the expression of this feeling a large part of the message I send back to Madame de Malrive.
Oh, I told you I had my reasons. And since you are here, and the mere sight of you assures me that you are as well as Fanny charged me to find you, with all these preliminaries disposed of, I am going to relieve you in a small measure of the weight of your obligation.
By telling me to do something in return?
By asking you to answer me a question.
That seems very little to do.
Don't be so sure. It is never very little to your race.
Well, try me.
I want to begin by saying that I believe I once did you an injustice to the extent of misunderstanding your motive for a certain action.
If we must go back to that.
You withdraw your assent to my request?
By no means. But nothing consolatory you can find to say on that point can really make any difference.
Will not the difference in my view of you perhaps make a difference in your own? It is really I who have an amende to make, as I now understand the situation. I once turned to you for help in a painful extremity, and I have only now learned to understand your reasons for refusing to help me.
Oh, my reasons.
I have learned to understand them by being so much lately with Fanny.
But I never told her.
Exactly. That was what told me. I understood you through her and through your dealings with her. There she was, the woman you adored and longed to save. And you would not lift a finger to make her yours by means which would have seemed, I see it now, a desecration of your feeling for each other. It came to me first when I found you had never breathed to her a word of our talk together. She had confidently commissioned you to find a way for her, as the medieval lady sent a prayer to her knight to deliver her from captivity. And you came back, confessing you had failed, but never justifying yourself by so much a hint of the reason why. You couldn't even, with my permission, betray to anyone a hint of my miserable secret. And you couldn't, for your life's happiness, pay the particular price that I asked. Oh, we are of different races, with a different point of honor. But I understand. I see that you are good people. Just simply, courageously, good. Have I understood you? That, you understand, is my question.
What can it matter when the upshot is something I infinitely regret?
Having refused me? Don't! Oh, I have suffered. But I have learned also. My life has been enlarged. You see how I have understood you both? And that is something I should have been incapable of a few months ago.
I can't think that you've ever been incapable of any generous interpretation.
If you knew into what language I have always translated life. But that is not what you are here to learn.
I think that I'm here to learn the measure of Christian charity.
Ah, no. But to show it.
To show it? And to whom?
Do you remember that day I talked with you at Fanny's, the day after you came back from Italy?
Yes.
You asked me then what return I expected for my service to you, as you called it. And I answered, the contemplation of your happiness. Well, do you know what that meant in my old language? The language I was still speaking then? It meant that I knew there was horrible misery in store for you, and that I was waiting to feast my eyes on it. That's all.
What misery do you mean?
Have you never asked yourself why our family consented so readily to a divorce?
Yes, often. But Fanny was so reassured, so convinced that we owed it to your good offices.
My good offices? Will you never, you Americans, learn that we do not act individually in such cases, that we are all obedient to a common principle of authority?
Then it was not you.
Oh, you are too confiding. It is the other side of your beautiful good faith.
Besides, you've taken advantage of, it appears.
We, all of us. I especially.
Why then did you consent to the divorce?
To get the boy back. Is it possible you never suspected? It has been our whole thought from the first. Everything was planned with that object.
But the divorce? How could that give him back to you?
It was the only thing that could. We trembled lest the idea should occur to you. But we were reasonably safe, for there has only been one other case of the same kind before the courts. You didn't know that in that case, on the remarriage of the mother, the courts instantly restored the child to the father, though he had, well, given as much cause for divorce as my unfortunate brother.
Your French justice takes a grammar and dictionary to understand.
We understand it, and it isn't necessary that you should.
So it would appear.
Don't judge us too harshly. Or not at least till you have taken the trouble to learn our point of view. You consider the individual. We think only of the family.
Why don't you take care to preserve it, then?
That's what we do, in spite of every aberration of the individual. And so, when we saw it was impossible that my brother and his wife should live together, we simply transferred our allegiance to the child. We constituted him the family.
A precious kindness you did him. If the result is to give him back to his father.
That, I admit, is to be deplored. But his father is only a fraction of the whole. What we really do is to give him back to his race, his religion, his true place in the order of things.
His mother never tried to deprive him of any of those inestimable advantages.
Not consciously, perhaps, but silences and reserves can teach so much. His mother has another point of view.
Thank heaven.
Thank heaven for her, yes, perhaps. But it would not have done for the boy.
You haven't yet convinced me that it won't have to do for him. At the time of Madame de Malrive's separation, the court made no difficulty about giving her the custody of her son. And you must pardon me for reminding you that the father's unfitness was the reason alleged.
And my poor brother, you would add, has not changed. But the circumstances have. And that proves precisely what I have been trying to show you, that in such cases the general course of events is considered, rather than the action of any one person.
Then why is Madame de Malrive's action to be considered?
Because it breaks up the unity of the family.
Unity?
Of the family tradition, I mean. It introduces new elements. You are a new element.
Thank heaven.
Yes. You may thank heaven. Why isn't it enough to satisfy Fanny?
Why isn't what enough?
Your being, as I say, a new element, taking her so completely into a better air. Why shouldn't she be content to begin a new life with you without wanting to keep the boy, too?
I don't know what you mean.
I mean that in her place, she may have another son. The son of the man she adores.
Your idea, then, is that I should tell her nothing.
Tell her now? But my poor friend, you would be ruined.
Exactly. Then why have you told me?
We see things so differently. Can't you conceive that after all that has passed, I felt it a kind of loyalty not to leave you in ignorance?
And you feel no such loyalty to her.
I leave her to you.
You don't leave her to me. You take her from me at a stroke. I suppose I ought to thank you for doing it before it's too late.
I take her from you? No, I simply prevent your going to her unprepared. Well, you will think me stupid, but my warning you of this is the only return I know how to make for your generosity. I could not bear to have you say afterward that I had deceived you twice.
Twice?
I deceived you once, that night at your cousin's when I tried to get you to bribe me. Even then, we meant to consent to the divorce. It was decided the first day that I saw you. You see from what a milieu you are taking her.
She will never give up her son.
How can she help it? After you are married, there will be no choice.
No. But there is one now.
Now? Haven't I made it clear to you? Haven't I shown you your course? I love Fanny, and I am ready to trust her happiness to you.
I shall have nothing to do with her happiness.
Are you afraid?
Afraid?
Of not being able to make it up to her?
No. If I had the chance, I believe I could.
I knew you could.
That's the worst of it.
The worst?
Don't you see that I can't deceive her? Can't trick her into marrying me now.
Is happiness never more to you then than this abstract standard of truth?
I don't know. It's an instinct. There doesn't seem to be any choice.
Oh, then I am a miserable wretch for not holding my tongue.
That would not have helped me. And it would have been 1,000 times worse for her.
Nothing can be as bad for her as losing you. Aren't you moved by seeing her need?
Horribly. Are not you?
You mean, why don't I help you? Why don't I use my influence? Oh, if you knew how I have tried.
And you were sure that nothing can be done?
Nothing. Nothing. What arguments can I use? We abhor divorce. We go against our religion in consenting to it. And nothing short of recovering the boy could possibly justify us.
Then there is nothing to be done.
Wait. There is one thing more. And that is to believe that I am deceiving you again.
That you're deceiving me?
Yes.
About the boy?
Yes. Why shouldn't I? You're so credulous. The temptation is irresistible.
No. It would be too easy to find out.
Don't try, then. Go on as if nothing had happened. I have been lying to you.
Do you give me your word of honor?
A liar's? I haven't any. Take the logic of facts instead. What reason have you to believe any good of me? And what reason have I to do any to you? Why on earth should I betray my family for your benefit? Ah, don't let yourself be deceived to the end.
I should first have to find a reason for your deceiving me.
Why? I gave it to you long ago. I wanted to punish you. And now I have punished you enough.
Yes. You've punished me enough.
It is you who are punishing me now. I tell you, I am false to the core. Look back and see what I have done to you.
You poor, good woman.
You're going to her. Straight from here.
Yes. Straight from here.
To tell her everything. To renounce your hope.
That is what it amounts to, I suppose.
You poor, good man.
The part of Madame de Trem was played by Anna Massey, John Durham by Philip Voss, and Fanny de Malrive by Gwen Humble. Bessie Boykin, Elizabeth Kelly, Elmer Boykin, James Green. Mrs. Durham, Oriel Smith, Nanny, Jane Whittenshaw, Katie, Tara Dominic, and the narrator was Valerie Serouf. Madame de Trem was adapted by John Peacock from the novella by Edith Wharton and directed by Jane Morgan.